So why don't we resume? Did Aristotle know anything about inflation? Offhand, I can't recall whether he discusses it in the Politics or not. Earlier, I mentioned the two theories of value in economic circles in the 19th century. One is the cost of production theory, and one is the utility theory. And both schools of thought were puzzled by something that I've forgotten who first brought up, but it hinged on the question of objective value. And here was the problem. Someone posed the question, why is water, which is absolutely necessary for human life, why is water, which is absolutely necessary for human life, almost without cost, very low cost? And diamonds, very low price on water, and diamonds, which are completely superfluous, very expensive. Why is water, this is the puzzle, because water has great objective value. Diamonds, well, this is in the 19th century, the industrial use of diamonds hadn't been discovered. All they were good for was jewelry, ornamentation. Something everybody could do without. Now, why is one so costly and one almost free? Well, the cost of production school, to which Marx and others belong, said, well, it's the cost of production involved. It doesn't cost very much to produce water. You can get it out of the river. You can get it from a spring. You can dig a well 20 feet and get water. It doesn't cost very much. But diamonds, you've got to dig a mine 100 feet into the ground or whatever, and it's very hard. The cost of production is high compared to water. And they said, well, obviously our theory explains it. And then some economist on the other side replied, well, how does that explain the value of a diamond that you simply find lying on top of the ground? And all you do is bend over and pick it up. And diamonds have been found simply lying on the ground. It happened in North Carolina. People simply bend over and pick diamonds up off the ground. How does that explain the value of those diamonds? There's no cost of production for those diamonds, and yet they are costly as well. They're high prices. Well, Marx might come up with that response, that they are exchangeable or they're similar to ones that have a high cost of production. Now, the utility theorist said, well, we've got to do something here because water is much more useful than diamonds are. But our theory says that those things that have a greater utility ought to be worth more, but water is worth less. And you have this diamond water problem that the economists are puzzling over in the 19th century. Finally, you have these three fellows again, Jevons, Balraux, and Menger, come up with a theory of not utility, but marginal utility. Marginal utility. Based on their idea of subjective value. Now, what do we mean by marginal utility? Well, it's sometimes difficult for students to grasp this idea, and I'm not sure why. And I'll try to be as clear about it as I can as to what we mean by marginal utility. Utility, to begin with, is just another word for usefulness. Usefulness. Marginal utility is the usefulness of the last unit, the unit at the margin. Imagine you have a piece of paper here and you have a margin here. And you have items here and you've got the last unit is in the margin. It's on the border. The last unit. Now, to use a standard example that economists use, I don't know how economists would get along without Robinson Crusoe. So I'll bring up Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe stranded on his desert island, he's got five sacks of grain. He's got five sacks of grain. The first sack is necessary to keep him alive. The second sack is necessary to keep him healthy. The third sack of grain he can use to make whiskey. Hope that's okay in this situation. He's making some beverage to drink. The fourth sack he can use to make cake. And the fifth sack he uses to feed the seagulls on its desert island. Now, we aren't going to determine which sack is which because they're homogeneous. All the sacks of grain are identical. He just has these different uses, these different utilities he can put them to. Now, the marginal utility is feeding the seagulls for his own entertainment. That's the marginal utility of these five sacks of grain. What value does Robinson impute to any one of these sacks of grain? What value does he impute, does he ascribe to any one of these sacks of grain? Yes, sir. Seagull food. That's right, seagull food. That is, the utility of the marginal unit is imputed to all the units. Because if he loses any one sack of grain, no matter which one he loses, all he loses is seagull food. Now, if he loses his second sack of grain, he loses his cake. It's getting more serious now. If he loses a third sack of grain, he loses his beverage. If he loses his fourth sack, he loses his health. If he loses his fifth sack, he loses his life. And again, we're not assigning numbers to any of these bags of grain. It really doesn't matter which one you pick. They're homogeneous. We're assuming they're uniform in quality and quantity and everything. But he has these five different uses for them. Now, this goes back to the passage that we read earlier in Mark about the rich people putting money into the treasury and the poor widow putting money in. She was down, if I can mix my stories here, she was down to her last sack of grain and she puts it in the treasury. The rich were giving up seagull food. She was giving her livelihood. But the value that's imputed to any of these sacks of grain is determined by that marginal usefulness, that marginal value. That's the value that's imputed to them all. It's only as you lose sacks of grain, as you consume them, that the value you impute to these things goes up. After the first bag of grain disappears, now Robinson imputes a higher value to each of them. After the second bag disappears, now it's a still higher value. And when he's down to his last bag of grain, he values that very highly indeed. That represents his life, or in the case of the poor widow, her livelihood, her life. That's what it represents. Now, the marginal utility theorists, Jevons and Valois and Menger, use this new idea based on subjective value. You see, the value imputed, those sacks of grain, are not of equal value. They're not of intrinsic value. The value changes as the supply changes. As that supply of grain changes, the value imputed to each unit of the supply changes. And they use this theory of marginal utility to solve the diamond water paradox without adopting a cost of production theory. Because water is so plentiful, we ascribe to all water, we impute to all water the least or the marginal utility of water, which might be pouring out on the ground, water fights, whatever it might be. That's how we determine the value of water to us, the value of that least useful unit of water. Diamonds, however, are a different matter. The same principle applies to diamonds, but there isn't this enormous abundance of diamonds as there is an enormous abundance of water. Diamonds are very rare. They're scarce. Water's scarce too, but diamonds are scarcer than water. And they have a high value because the least useful thing that you do with a diamond is now ascribed to all diamonds. He said, what explains this diamond water paradox is this theory of subjective value combined with this theory of marginal utility. When we have so many things, such as Robinson had of his sacks of grain, then we ascribe the value, or we impute the value of the least useful unit to all the grain. If we're very rich, the value of the least useful unit of our money, our dollar, is what we ascribe to all of them. So we can be very generous with giving gifts to the temple treasury, simply because the value we're ascribing to them is very low. Now, some wealthy people get criticized very often because they seem to waste money. They seem to waste money. They have so much money that sometimes they get criticized for spending it lavishly. But if you look at this from their point of view and understand marginal utility and subjective value, they are acting in their self-interest when they do so. So they may not shop around for a car. They'll just go out to the car dealer and write them out a check. Had they been more interested in the value of their dollars, perhaps they could have gotten that car for $5,000 or $10,000 less if they negotiated with the car dealer. But they go out and simply write out a check because they value that amount of money less than their time consumed in negotiating a better deal. It's of less value to them, that $5,000 or $10,000 they might have saved on buying a car, than their time that they consume in negotiating a deal. The marginal utility of money causes them to value those dollars less than a poor person would. Now, marginal utility applies to time as well. The usefulness of time. Young people, they tend to think we've got our whole lives ahead of us. We've got time to waste. We can spend time playing. We can spend time in games. We can spend time going to the beach. We can spend time doing this and doing that. When you get to be my age, and it appears that the time you have allotted is much less than when you were 15 or 20, then each day becomes much more valuable. The marginal utility of time, because we have presumably we have a smaller supply. Now, we don't know for sure. People do die young. But that's the way we look at our lives. We anticipate that we're going to live when we're young. Of course, when we're young, we think we're going to live forever. But we anticipate that we're going to live for 70 years, 80 and 10. And if by reason of strength, 80. So we spend time that someone like me, looking back on youth, would say, you're wasting time. Because I have much less time than you do. I've got 30 or 40 years left. And the value of each day, each year increases. Not only does it go by faster, as you get older, time passes more swiftly, but the value of each year increases as you get older because your supply of time is dwindling. And you try to figure out how best to use your time. So you may turn down certain opportunities because they are not in your best interest to use your time in that way. You have a better use for your time. Marginal utility just doesn't apply to sacks of grain or to dollars, but to everything we value. If we have a large supply of whatever it is we value, we will tend to ascribe or impute a value to it that will reflect the marginal utility of that thing, the marginal usefulness of that thing to us. Well, this is, for some reason, this idea of marginal utility is sometimes difficult to get across. I don't know how I'm doing. Anybody have any questions? Yes, sir.
It seems like what you're saying is marginal utility is the same as utility, because when you find water and you find it as plentiful as it is, it seems like it would be more useful to have a unit, a separate unit, that looked at the last unit as though everything else had been spent, because that would be neat. That would make it neat from the general.
Well, you don't want to look at the last unit as though everything else has been spent, because that means it's your only unit. You have to look at it in the context of the whole.
But isn't that the same as utility then? Because that's the condition in which you find...
Well, the marginal utility idea says that the usefulness is not intrinsic to the object. The usefulness of the object varies with the supply of the object. That was my illustration about the Robinson Crusoe and his sacks of grain. The utility varies with the supply. And the marginal utility is the least useful unit, the seagull food.
Okay, so it is the same thing. It's just a better way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it also doesn't depend on this being objective or fixed.
Right.
It's subjective and always changing. When you combine this idea of marginal utility with subjective value, you see that the value is always changing, and it's always subjective. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Yes, they all published books about 1870. Yes, it is saying that. Mm-hmm. Yes, it did. Aristotle was a very influential fellow. After all, Thomas Aquinas referred to him as the philosopher with a capital T and a capital P. The philosopher. Enormous respect for Aristotle. And Aristotle became the authority alongside of Scripture and the Church. From antiquity. Yes, sir.
Is those three gentlemen alive independently?
Completely independently. And this is not unusual in the history of ideas. You find people independently making the same inventions and the same discoveries in science. I'm not quite sure why it happens, apart from the general explanation of the providence of God. But you see this quite frequently in the history of ideas. People hitting upon the same idea at about the same time. You have calculus. Newton is usually credited with calculus, but Leibniz, the German philosopher, developed it at about the same time, and he and Newton went at each other as to who actually originated calculus. Leibniz also criticized Newton's theory, pointed out what the contradictions in them, but nobody paid any attention to Leibniz until the 20th century, when Einstein did the same thing. But there you have, in the 17th century, two men, one in England and one in Germany, or what later became Germany, coming up with calculus, independently of each other, at the same time. So it's fascinating to read the history of ideas, because you run across things like that many times. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, his value changes in his mind. He no longer values the feeding seagulls. That's for his entertainment. Perhaps he's found another way to entertain himself rather than feeding seagulls. So it really doesn't matter how many sacks you divide it into. What's important is the usefulness and the usefulness of the last unit. Yes, sir.
As the water and iron start off, if there is a shortage of water, the water can become a lot more valuable than the diamond.
Precisely. If there is a drought, If there is a famine, then water, the marginal utility of water, is no longer pouring it out on the ground or water fights or watering your plants, your flowers, or your lawn, or washing your car. It now becomes drinking water, or the food becomes necessary to sustain life. So you find examples in Scripture, and I was discussing this with this gentleman during the break, examples in Scripture where cities are under siege, and they gladly trade their jewelry and their gold and their silver for a tiny bit of food. Gladly. The value is not intrinsic in the gold or the silver or in the jewelry. It's subjective, and as circumstances change, and circumstances always change, as circumstances change, the values of these things in our minds change. So in famine conditions, we're willing to give up a pound of gold for a pound of bread. We'll do it gladly. Yes, sir. The doctrine of providence.
That is the first time to change, and therefore a value change.
Well, I hadn't thought about it, but God obviously is the cause of the drought or the famine, whatever. And perhaps those things are used or intended by him to cause us to rethink our priorities in certain situations. When the church is persecuted, there's no persecution except by the will of God of the church. And he's going to use that persecution to weed out the deadwood in the church. The true believers will be true believers. They will remain faithful. Well, in many cases they do. I'm not sure that the looters in Argentina do, but in many cases they have a better value system. Paul says, I've forgotten which letter it's in now offhand, but he says that divisions must come and heresies must come so that those who are true to the faith will be revealed. And he says even the coming of heresies and divisions in the church are not apart from the will of God, and God is using them to show who is approved by him. Tony? Perhaps some of you can help me here, in which David is musing about why the rich are, or why the evil, why the wicked are so prosperous, why they're so rich. And he says, I didn't understand it until I saw their end. He says, then once I understood their end, I can see what God is doing. He says, why would God make these wicked people so prosperous, so wealthy? So rich. Says, and it bothered me. Does anyone know which psalm it is? 73. Why don't we look at that? Psalm 73, truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart, but as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pangs in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride serves as their necklace, violence covers them like a garment, their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walks through the earth. Therefore his people return here, and waters of a full cup are drained by them, and they say, how doth God know, and is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the ungodly, who are always at ease. They increase in riches. Surely I have cleansed my heart in vain, and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long I have been plagued and chastened every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have been untrue to the generation of your children. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. Surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how are they brought to desolation, as in a moment? They are utterly consumed with terrors, as a dream when one wakes. So, Lord, when you awake, you shall despise their image. Thus my heart was grieved, and I was vexed in my mind. I was so foolish and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold me by my right hand. You will guide me with your counsel, and afterward receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is none upon earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For indeed those who are far from you shall perish. You have destroyed all those who desert you for harlotry. But it is good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in the Lord God, that I may declare all your works. So there you have the psalmist bothered by the same question about the prosperity of the wicked, and it bothers him until he understands their end. And God has given them abundance, he's saying here, in order to make it worse for them at the end. He's done that in order to make it worse for them. He's contrasting the prosperous wicked with the poor godly, the fellow who's chastened every morning and plagued every day. But he says this poor godly fellow is going to be blessed in heaven forever. And, of course, this idea is consistently found throughout Scripture, that the world to come is of much more value, and we ought to value it much more than the present world. We ought to understand the end of things rather than just what is visible on earth and be bothered by it. So in God's providence, he can withhold material blessings and give great eternal rewards to people. And he can also give great material blessings and withhold eternal rewards from them. Give them great punishment, in fact. And the material blessings make them proud and arrogant. They think that they got what they got by their own strength and by their own ability. And they're punished for it. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Go ahead. Okay, back to Robinson. Well, in Robinson's case, it would make no difference. He would still regard that fifth sack with the same imputed value as the other four, that is, seagull food. Now, as he consumed the grain, the value of that fifth sack would become, of course, his livelihood or his wife. But at that point, it would make no difference in his thinking. What's he going to do with it? Put it behind a rock or something? It's still going to be sitting there. And while he's not using it for anything, you could argue that all the sacks are saving.
for him.
But now his marginal utility would change if the seagulls got into it, and now you're down to cake. And now he will value each of the sacks more highly than he did before. Yes, sir.
What if you said this? So each sack is going to last for 2 months, and I got 5 sacks for 10 months, and I don't know if you can make more food after that, but I'm going to value each sack as 10 months.
He won't do that. He won't do that. What he will do, if he uses his rational capacity, he'll say, well, it's not guaranteed I'm going to be rescued in 10 months. So what he's going to do is look for alternative supplies of food. And he will try to catch fish, or he will hunt, or look for berries. Or maybe he'll discover Friday on the other side of the island. And together they can more than double their output, because they'll be doing something that we'll get into later. They'll be dividing their labor, and by cooperating in that fashion, they can more than double their productivity. Yes.
Yeah,
the value changes. And if you would be pretending if you tried to talk yourself into saying, I'm going to value each of them as sustaining my life. Because you will not, as a matter of fact, do that. But, you know, by your use of the word really and really, really, you know, you're indicating a change in value here, even though you're trying to kid yourself into thinking that each one means my life, when it doesn't. Each one doesn't mean your life. But the important thing is, and I don't want this to be obscured, he values and we value every unit, every item we have of a supply of things at the least useful level. That's the important point. And that seems to be the problem people have in understanding. Any one of those 5 sacks of grain is valued at the seagull food level until one of them is gone. And when one is gone, it goes up to the cake level. And then we value it more. And so the poor widow has 2 small copper coins worth a fraction of a cent. And that is her whole livelihood. And when she gives them away, she's doing it because she values that action more than her own livelihood. Yes, sir.
How is marginal utility affected by production?
Well, we're getting way ahead of ourselves here. How is marginal utility affected by production?
Unlimited wealth? We don't believe in limited wealth. As good capital is usually wealth can be built.
Yes. And as wealth is increased, the marginal utility of any unit of it declines. So if production is increased, whatever it might be, automobiles, soda, whatever it might be, the marginal utility of any one unit declines.
But that's the Friday factor.
That's the Friday factor. The only caveat I'd add to that, unless for some reason the value that we attribute to these things changes for a different reason, perhaps that could happen as well. Suppose we discover tomorrow that coke is useful for refining gold. Now the marginal utility of a bottle of coke might actually increase from what it is today, if we think that we have a new use for an item like that. Then even if the production of coke were to increase, perhaps its marginal utility would increase as well, because now we have a new idea in our minds. When we get a little bit further along here, will see that the idea of subjective value has enormous implications for economic growth. For example, there are no such things as natural resources. There are no such things as natural resources. I used to live in New Mexico. They mined something down there called uranium. Up until 50 years ago, or at most 100 years ago, this stuff was worthless. It was sitting there in the rocks of New Mexico, but it was worthless. Up until 150 years ago, petroleum was worthless. It was something that got in the way. When it leaked out of the ground, it was a mess. It got in the way. Until somebody figured out how to use it, they had an idea about this stuff, how to make it a substitute for whale oil, which was commonly used in the 19th century for light. The whales were hunted for their oil. Natural resources develop as people come up with new ideas about things and ascribe value to them. They aren't just lying out there. Uranium was useless. Petroleum was useless. Uranium was useless for thousands of years. It was there, but it was worthless. It's only until somebody has an idea on how to use this thing that it becomes a valuable resource. Yes, sir.
Well, to me, there's two categories here. Part of the material is money, that's all.
And that's a complicating factor, right?
Well, here we go. Yeah. If dollar bills are what we have some of, it seems like if we have more of them, then because of our utility, each one of the dollars is less. Well, how does that factor when we have to admire it? It doesn't seem like they put any less value, you know, they have more of this commodity.
Okay.
So is that still true, or is it another category to a moral?
No, I don't think you've jumped a category at all. I think it's a good question. How do you account for the miser? How does the miser fit in with the theory of marginal utility? Because a miser, I've never met one, but presumably the definition is someone who just hoards money and seems to treat it all as of very high value. You know, he doesn't spend it, hides it under his mattress or whatever, buries it in the ground. He's a miser. Well, he's got such a high, he places such a high value on money that no matter how much he gets, even though he may value, his utility may decrease with each unit, it's unnoticeable, but because he places such a high value on it. So he's going to hoard it all, and he's not going to use it for anything. Yeah, they're rare people, but I presume there are people like that. I knew a fellow that he wasn't a miser by any means, but he, back in the 70s, I guess it was, he was convinced that we were going to go into a hyperinflation. And he was a fairly well-to-do man. He bought a lot of gold coins, and he had a farm in Virginia, buried them on the farm, all over the farm. Just these enormous tubes of gold coins. Because they were his inflation hedge. And he never had to use them. And he died at the end of the 1980s, I guess, and his farm was sold after that. And I always wondered if perhaps I should have bought that farm. Knowing that this fellow had buried all this stuff over there. But he wasn't a miser. He just thought it would be a good inflation hedge because he did spend money. He didn't spend that particular gold, but he did spend money and a very prosperous businessman. Yes?
Would a miser also be indebted?
Oh, he could.
If there are two programs and so half his money, he'd be upset and say, oh, if I had half, would he be more upset if he sold it all?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And subjective value applies to misers as well as everyone else. The what makes a miser is this extraordinary importance he attaches to money. And he's not going to part with it. He's sort of your ultimate mercantilist. He's not going to export any money at all. Yes?
Yeah.
The marginal utility is dependent upon subjective value.
Yes, they're connected very closely with each other. Marginal utility and subjective value, you can't understand the one without the other. If we tried to combine marginal utility with objective value, it makes no sense, because in Aristotle's theory, a sheep is a sheep is a sheep. They're all of the same value. Marginal utility and subjective value explain why some sheep are worth less than other sheep. Habits are hard to break.
Yeah.
Comment is, it's easy to give money. What counts is time. And again, it would vary from individual to individual, I would say, whether it's more easy to give money than time. We perhaps expect young people to give time more than we expect older people, because young people have more time than they have money in charitable activities. But whether it's easier for a given individual to give time or money is something that only that individual can decide. And perhaps, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on, it would be stupid for the person to give time rather than money. And let me explain what I mean. I'll just give you an example. Michael Jordan's been in the news a lot lately with the Bulls winning the championship. Suppose Michael Jordan decided that he wanted to feed the hungry people of Chicago. Now, should he give his time or his money to do this? Should he go out and work in a soup kitchen? Should he go out and become a farmer and raise crops for the hungry people of Chicago? Or should Michael Jordan go play a game of basketball and make $300,000 playing one game of basketball, and then give the proceeds to buy food to feed the hungry people in Chicago? Now, the answer is, obviously, he ought to play basketball. And when we talk about comparative advantage, we'll talk about that a little more. He would be hurting the hungry people of Chicago if he quit basketball and worked in a soup kitchen. If he gave his time instead of his money, he would be hurting them. And what the comment is getting at, I think, is missing the whole point of charity. The whole point of charity is to help the person that you're supposed to be helping, not to make yourself feel good. But you hear that all the time on television. Oh, you should go out and help. It really makes you feel good. Go down to the soup kitchen. It really makes you feel good. Doing that sort of thing. But that's not the point of charity. The point of charity is to help the person that needs the help. And if Michael Jordan can help more people by playing one game of basketball and giving the proceeds to the soup kitchens of Chicago, then he ought to do that. He's not going to help very many people by actually going down to the soup kitchen and donating his time. Now, I can use another example, perhaps more realistic, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter goes around the country working for Habitat for Humanity, building houses. He actually uses a hammer and a saw. And he goes out and builds houses. Now, I don't know how good a carpenter Jimmy Carter is. But I would guess that in the amount of time it takes him to build a house, he could be giving a lecture, be paid $25,000 for that lecture, or maybe 10 lectures in the amount of time it takes him to build a house, and make $250,000, and use that money to pay real carpenters to build real houses for homeless people. Now, It may make Jimmy feel better to go out and use a hammer than if he simply writes a check. But if the goal is to actually help homeless people, he ought to give the lectures and write the checks. Yes, sir.
I said that there's a promotional value to an ex-president going out and doing something and saying,
okay. Okay, this is a good point. You have a celebrity like Jimmy Carter going out and building houses using a hammer, and there's a promotional value here. It encourages other people who don't know how to build houses to go out and put together houses when perhaps they ought to be going to do what they're good at and writing checks to carpenters who can build houses for homeless people. But there is that promotional value.
That's the reality of everyday life. I build cabinets.
Yes, sir.
If I build a cabinet, let's say I can earn $200 a day building a cabinet, and let's say I can have a plumber come and set a sink a year and $200 doing plumbing every day. But if I do my own plumbing, it takes me 3 days to do one day's job. Which job should I do? Building more cabinets and getting someone else to do plumbing.
You guys are way ahead of me. That's the whole lecture on comparative advantage. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think sometimes the content makes a decision here from the plumbing friend. I don't know who that is, but so I can't say what she meant. But I think sometimes they're making a statement that it's not economic. That they're saying, for instance, you can't just give money to your kids. You've got to spend time with them. You can't raise a godly seed by giving them a really big allowance.
Yeah, and if that is her intention, that Tony is neglecting his children and ought to be spending time with his children rather than handing them out the checks or whatever, now that may be a completely legitimate criticism. I presume that's not what's intended here. But in that case, you do have an obligation. What was that?
I didn't presume that.
Oh, okay. But in something like that, you do have an obligation, obviously, to spend time with your children and to raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And in that context in Deuteronomy where it speaks of that, the idea is the parents are with the children much of the day. You know, when you rise up, you speak of the law. When you eat, you speak of the law. When you work, when you play, whatever you do, you talk about the counsel of the Lord with the children. And that is spending time with them. And that's obviously very valuable in raising, in rearing children. What's that? The question is, was there some event that was the occasion for this peculiar thing happening? And not to my knowledge. I know of none. Yes, sir.
Isn't it the same thing that people during lifetimes in a different situation, people are experiencing a lot of the same types of things, so they invest something because, everybody, my wife, his wife, that person's wife, all of them has to clean it out and go through it. So they all come up and say, well, I invest something to help her wash those clothes.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that sense, it's true. The debate in economic theory during the 19th century had come to an impasse between these two schools of thought, and they said, well, how are we going to make any progress? How do we solve this impasse that we've come to? We're in a Mexican standoff, as it were, here. And how do we solve this? And these fellows said, well, the only way you're going to solve it is by jettisoning this idea of objective value. You have to throw that overboard. And then you have to understand utility as marginal utility, rather than saying that all things are equal in value to each other, all sheep or all oxen or whatever. Yes, sir. About 1870. 1870. So that's when I would date the beginning of economic theory. Economics is a little over 100 years old. Yes, sir. But go ahead.
I was a little intrigued by your question here. I'm wondering, the Industrial Revolution is something which was mostly after that. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if because of machines and so forth, and a rapid increase in supply, that might have been an impetus for people saying, well, we've got more, and they don't think, when you can see change happen rapidly, then you're more likely to want to explain it?
Well, actually, the Industrial Revolution had begun long before then, and Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations comments on pin making. He talks about the pin making machines that were developed and how one pin making machine could make as much as 100 pin makers who made them by hand. But still, he didn't arrive at these theories. You know, you may say that something like that is the occasion for it and should have caused them to think about it, but it doesn't explain why Smith missed it and John Stuart Mill missed it and these guys came up with it. Yes, Tommy.
Well, in
Marx's thought, the cost of production became labor. Marx argued that the only relevant cost of production is labor. That's the only real cost of production. It's not the machines, because the value of the machines is due to the labor that went into them, the labor putting them together. So he said the only cost of production is labor. And out of this theory, he developed his entire theory of exploitation and why the capitalist society was doomed and the workers would overthrow it. He argued first that since the only relevant cost of production is labor, the laborers, the workers, ought to get all the proceeds from the sale of the goods. But they don't. They're exploited. And today, many people still are under that same idea, that businesses, employers, as a matter of routine, exploit the workers. They take from them what it rightfully belongs to them. And labor ought to get everything that comes in from the sale of the product, whatever the product it is.
Can I just add labor and material?
Mm-hmm.
Now, material costs change upon the availability of trees. A few trees, cost of that material, but how does that factor in the cost of production?
You mean in the Marxist theory?
Yeah.
The labor involved in getting the trees. He made allowance for what you might call natural resources, but again, it's the labor, the guys that go out and harvest the trees. Their value goes up in that case. I don't know. I suppose in some other cases, the Marxist theory is still with us today. Speaking of Japan, Japan's in the news. Of course, Japan's in a recession, and the news today was that the Prime Minister of Japan and the President of the U.S. had a late-night conversation about how the U.S. would bail out the Japanese yen. And they're doing so today. They've sold, they've traded lots of dollars for yen to try to bring up the value of the yen. In return, we're told that Clinton extracted certain promises from the Prime Minister of Japan. And a couple of these promises are very interesting. One is that they will reduce taxes, so far so good. The other is that they will stimulate their economy. Now this is the language of John Maynard Keynes. So the question came up the other night, how much influence does Keynes still have? Well, Keynes is alive and well in international trade here, because now you have the U.S. government telling the Japanese government that, yes, we'll help you if you guys stimulate your economy by spending more and more. Let's have deficit spending. Cut the taxes, increase spending. Now, Japan's already running enormous deficits. What this will do to the economy of Japan is probably not good. Now, they complicated things by saying you've got to deregulate and that, which is all beneficial. You've got to deregulate and allow more competition and that sort of thing. And that's all beneficial, so it won't be clear-cut. But when you see the phrase, stimulate the economy, you're listening to John Maynard Keynes, even though you may not know it. Or even though Bill Clinton may not know it. He probably called Robert Rubin at 11:30 last night and said, what do I tell him, Bob? And Bob says, tell him to stimulate the economy. Any other questions or comments here? Yes, sir. Yes, you are. If you sell, if the market value of plywood goes to $200 a sheet and you sell it for less, you're losing money. Your cost of selling it for less is the difference between what you sell it for and what the market price is. So if you sell it for $20 a sheet and you could get $200 for a sheet, you're losing $180 a sheet.
So would you say
it would
be more of a No,
not at all.
Well,
we'll talk about this in a later lecture when I bring up ethics of competition and trade. And not at all. Do you think that a surgeon who collects $5,000 for an operation is taking advantage of someone's misfortune? You know, perhaps he's in the operating room for an hour, sends the fellow a bill for $5,000. Now, obviously, the fellow's in bad shape. He needed surgery. Should the surgeon not charge him $5,000? Is that taking advantage of his misfortune? Well, yes, but I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that. So if you kill the head of family, then you're obligated to provide for his family for however long it takes. Yeah. Bring the children to the age of majority and provide for his widow.
If you are going to cover surgery, that's the economic
surgery. See, this is why everybody doesn't like economics. They think it's dirty. Well, when we talk about the function of prices, you'll understand what you should do with that plywood. You should sell it to the highest bidder. You should sell it to the highest bidder. If they're willing to pay you $200 a sheet for it, you should sell it to them for $200 a sheet. And what happens, or I'm getting way ahead of us now, we're about five steps out in front of this lecture on choice. What happens is that prices like this will cause all sorts of providers of plywood to ship plywood to the storm-damaged area. And that's precisely what they want. That will come down quick. That will come down quick. But what they desire, what they value at this point is a lot of plywood. And that's why they bid up the price to $200 a sheet. And if the government interferes and says, no, the price isn't going anywhere over $20 a sheet, that hurts the people that want the plywood. Because what's the point of shipping it in now? You can get $20 here in Vancouver. There's no sense in sending it to Florida. But if the price of plywood goes to $200 a sheet in Florida, every plywood manufacturer in the country is going to send their plywood to Florida. And they can send it there just to help, too, if they're doing it for PR purposes, I suppose, which would be why they do it. But they can do that. Any other questions or comments? You're anticipating a lot of the lecture on ethics here tonight. Yes, sir.
I was going to say, you want to act your own best interest, so sooner or later, it's $20. But if it was to feel like he's going to continue, or if he has kept some code of conduct, so people thought it was $200 or not. Well, without $180, he gets the benefit.
Well, in that case, if he thinks that it's wrong to sell it for $200, a piece of plywood, then he won't do it. And he would still be acting in his best interest because he has this sneaking suspicion that charging this much for plywood is wrong. And there are verses in Scripture that speak to this very point. See if you can find some.
That still brings us to the question of truth. Granted, everybody's got their own idea of what's right and wrong, and everyone has that course of conscience.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the phrase the leading of God, but apparently you have in your mind, if you would hesitate at doing that, charging a high price for plywood, that this is somehow unjust. And see, this is taking us right back to Thomas Aquinas. This takes us right back to Thomas Aquinas and right back to the idea of price controls that those who charge more than $20 a sheet for plywood are charging an unjust price, and unjust prices ought to be outlawed, so we're going to impose price control. And that's the origination of that whole idea. Then we'll see what the consequences of that are when we talk about prices. You think you're doing good in doing that, in passing such laws, but you're not. By your own criteria, you're not doing good. Yes. Would it change my answer, you mean? No. If people had a warning, you're saying they have a warning ahead of time.
So if they do not pass, okay, they're
down
the line.
No, it would not. Go ahead. Yes. The coercion comes in and saying, this gentleman here can't sell us plywood for more than $20. That's where the coercion comes in.
What happens is I go and my neighbor's in trouble and everything, so I give him that plywood for the same cost that I would sell it every day, even though other people are selling it for $200 or $300 a sheet. But I go ahead and do that, and after the storm's all over, that guy needs to use that cabin for it over there, and I'm going to sell him a set of cabin, and I tell him at the same price I was selling before, and he says, nope, I got people who can do it cheaper now.
That's good. That's good. Well, we need to cut it off. We've gone way over again, and I thank you for your attention and your questions, and I hope you'll come back tomorrow night.